The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but is that the first time you've heard the false start, I'm Looking Through You?
I'm not sure if it's the first time, but it's if I've heard it before, it's been a long time ago. And why was that on the American version of Rubber Soul?
My research shows, first of all, it was on the stereo iteration. And when you think about stereo in 1965, 66, it would have been heard by a minority of people. Now, by the time I got into Rubber Soul and heard it for the first time in its entirety, the Capitol version was the mid-70s. So the stereo had supplanted all the mono pressings. Now we're talking, you know, tape by that time. And it was the one that people coming to the Beatles after the 60s would have been the common currency in this country. And as to why, It's a weird thing because that was the tape that EMI shipped to Capitol, but only on the stereo version, not on the mono version. And apparently when questioned about it later, they were like, oh, we just assumed that they would chop that off because it's not on the mono version.
I mean, did no one in the Beatles camp, you know, exercise quality control over those American releases?
No, they did not.
It's just amazing. And it's amazing that maybe that some, you know, nasty missive wasn't sent to Capitol after this from George Martin or Brian or someone saying, like, what the hell?
Well, the quote had always been it had gotten to the point to where we pretty much stopped caring about what came out in America.
Because the biggest market.
The biggest market, only because they so had no control over it, how things were being sliced and diced and, you know, echo applied and all that stuff, that they were like, screw it. You know, it's gotten too out of control for us to do anything about. So, and they're selling anyway, so why not?
So by the time of Pepper, is that when did they actually...
The contract got renegotiated in January of 67.
Okay.
And that's when, I guess, there was a clause in there explicitly saying no more removing stuff from our albums for future releases. So that year, they do the opposite, and they pad an album and make Magical Mystery Tour. So very, very shrewd thinking there. Yeah. An album, a collection that made sense as a long player. They didn't do double EPs in America, so what are you going to do?
So this show is Rubber Soul at 50, the 50th anniversary of a classic Beatles album. But it's a classic Beatles album.
It's two classic Beatles
albums. Yeah, it's two. Yeah, well, I'm not so sure if it's two of them. But
It is. Look at it this way. Does your wife color her hair? Of course.
Well, I color mine, yeah.
Okay. So my point being, is one the real version, one not? It's a different flavor. You can have Rubber Soul in more than one version, and you know, you can go into the reasons why this was a mercenary money grubbing move by Capitol. But let's unpack that a bit, because I don't think it was all about calculation with them necessarily in terms of maximizing profits. I think that was more true in 1964, where you had to have a hit single and everything. But you take a look at this. This is the first Capitol album put out of Beatle material that didn't have a hit single on it, that wasn't built around a hit single. And here you had We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper right there. They conspicuously didn't add that to the album.
Well, let's explain for people who aren't familiar with the American version of Rubber Soul what the differences are. Basically, there are four tracks that are on the UK album, which are, I think, Drive My Car.
Yes.
Nowhere Man.
Yep.
What goes on, and If I Needed Someone.
Right.
None of which made the American version.
Right. But then you go back a few months in America when Help came out simultaneously in Britain and here, two very different albums, using the United Artists 1964 template for the Hard Day's Night soundtrack. They managed to take the British album and only feature the songs that were in the film, and then round out the rest of the album with incidental music from the score.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how big a taste there was for that in America among the young people buying Beatles records, who knows? I'm not going to speak to that. I mean, soundtracks were certainly big sellers in America, for sure. But so you had this bounty of leftover material from the UK Help that they naturally felt, you know, we can repurpose this. And from the UK Help album,
right,
they had Act Naturally, Yesterday, I've Just Seen a Face, and It's Only Love. So potentially, come, you know, whatever it is, 5 months later, they're putting out and compiling the Rubber Soul album from America. Those are the four songs they had at hand, plus I'm Down, the non-album flip of Help issued that summer. So they've got the 14 new tracks that were issued on the UK Rubber Soul. They've got two sides of the new single, We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper. And then they've got five other songs, Act Naturally, It's Only Love, yeah, I've Just Seen a Face, Yesterday and I'm Down.
Mm.
They've got a wealth of material here. Now, they could have stuck Yesterday on the American Rubber Soul. It had been a number one hit single in September, just a few months before. And there was plenty of precedent for this. You know, when they put out Beatles 6 at the start of summer in 1965, it had 8 days a week on it, which already been a hit. You know, Beatles 65 had... what is it? She's a Woman.
Don't ask me. I mean, my familiarity to this day with the American albums is minimal.
Right. But if you look at the pattern, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, they piggyback onto Meet the Beatles. Mm. So that's the lead-off track. Beatles' second album's got She Loves You on it.
Yeah.
Even though it originally came out on Swan.
Right.
Something New has got And I Love Her, If I Fell, stuff that had been issued as singles.
Uh-huh.
And Beatle 65's got I Feel Fine, She's a Woman. So the pattern had been for Capitol to utilize and make people buy the hit single and the album, get the same material. They didn't do that with Rubber Soul.
No, well, in this case, what they do is after they knock out those four songs, so from the wealth of other material that they've got from previous albums and releases, single releases, they start side one with I've Just Seen a Face and start side two with It's Only Love.
Right.
And then we get into this whole thing that is, oh, well, Capitol geared it to be a folk rock album to, you know, fit in with that emerging market in 1965.
Right. This was the year of the Byrds having two number one hit singles.
Right.
So, I mean, folk rock is everywhere. You know, Dylan has a number two with Like a Rolling Stone and a great sustained streak of hits that year.
Yeah.
So that is the thing going on that year. You know, Eve of Destruction.
But do you think that that is what Capitol was doing, actually trying to release a Beatles folk rock album?
I think that it's a hindsight justification that people looked at it years later and go, oh, I see. The two acoustic numbers that they added to the album in an album that's already got quite a few acoustic songs on it, not a ton. And they did conspicuously take off some of the electric stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, Nowhere Man, although it's got prominent acoustic rhythm guitar and harmonies and all that stuff.
But I tell you where it falls down for me. And, you know, I'd like to maybe do a little comparison here, which is we've got Run For Your Life on here with, you know, some acoustic guitar and electric and everything.
Yeah, kind of a rockabilly number.
Right. And then what do they leave off? Most likely the biggest Beatles folk rock number of all time.
The most Byrds-like song they ever did.
If I Needed Someone.
Absolutely.
Let's listen to both. So you see what I mean?
Yeah, that to me, the fact that they omitted If I Needed Someone is the greatest example of evidence that they weren't consciously crafting a folk rock album.
Right.
Otherwise, that would have been the lead-off song.
Right. So, absolutely.
Right. But it's also interesting they didn't put Yesterday on there, and they didn't put Act Naturally on there. Those are both sort of, you know, one's a pure acoustic with strings, and the other one is a country-ish album that easily could have fit along side some of the songs that are on that album.
Well, what happens also in the American version is that we now have no Ringo tracks.
Right.
And that was his first co-composition, of course.
What Goes On.
What Goes On.
Right.
And we have one less George track as well. George gets squeezed.
That's true.
You know, they change the whole nature. My issue is still, you know, call me a purist, but it's that, as you yourself said, they really weren't paying much attention to the American releases at this point. They're kind of given up on that kind of, you know, really lost track of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were so careful, the Beatles, in terms of how they compiled their albums, how they sequenced their albums. And so, you know, the thing that you were sort of saying, well, you know, does your wife dye a hair and they're both real? I get that, but I'm always going to go with what the Beatles wanted, what the Beatles intended. They were so in control, usually, of their own career and their own
That's true,
releases.
And I respect that. And there was the point in my fandom when I bought all the UK releases, and I was familiar with the Tony Tyler, Roy Carr book.
Mm.
So I knew what was considered the canon. And
And
I remember reading it as a kid thinking, oh, wow, this is different. And I get all that, but, you know, it needn't be a black and white situation because, you know, it's funny because for years I kind of like distanced myself and sort of demonized the American releases. And there's a few of them that you can legitimately, like the American Revolver minus the three Lennon songs, it's like, well, geez, that really warps the whole artistic intention. So I could see that. However, you can't take away the enjoyable listening experience that a lot of these American releases are, because, you know, Capitol weren't idiots. They wanted to make money like anybody else. And
I think they wanted to make money more than anybody else.
Well, yeah, you can make that case. However, I would also point out that it wasn't limited to Capitol. Mm-hmm. I mean, London in America was doing this with the Rolling Stones releases. Mm-hmm. Reprise was doing it with the Kinks releases.
It's all happening in America, though.
It is. So it is an American mindset, not a Capitol Records mindset, that we're going to take these limeys coming here and having a British invasion. We're going to create hay while the sun shines with their product.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, how would you have felt, though, if Capitol had released Sergeant Revolver? You know, and said, oh, you know, and it's all the psychedelic tracks or something. I mean,
yeah, and we can someday when we do our second guessing the Beatles show volume two, we can get into that. But there's definitely some legitimacy for crafting a listening experience that uses material that was around and how it might have been something cool. What you need to give Capitol credit for, and I know you didn't grow up on this, but the millions of people in America that did. It was an unbelievably canny move to open that album with I've Just Seen a Face straight into Norwegian Wood. Boom, boom. Whereas even after I got into the British albums, I thought Drive My Car into Norwegian Wood doesn't quite work the same. And that was years after having the Red album where they are back to back to listen to and get used to the idea. It's like, no. But on the other hand, if you're going to call an album Rubber Soul, it's kind of like, you know, Pepper, the whole concept falls apart after the first couple songs. Rubber Soul, you open with that Motown pastiche of Drive My Car, and then you kind of like lose the plot in terms of that. So in America, they could have called the album Plastic Folk, opening with I've Just Seen a Face.
Or Plastic Folk.
Or Plastic Folk, yeah, it's a pun. They could have had a picture of the Beatles having a picnic on the cover. But, you know, the Rubber
Robert's
Soul...
Robert's redesigning the Beatles' career.
Well, I second-guess everything. I always thought love songs should have been called Words of Love, because they already used a Beatle cover, rock and roll music, for the rock and roll music set. Words of Love would have encompassed everything. But I digress.
I mean, for me, how you can have... I mean, okay.
What?
People say you can't have Rubber Soul without Drive My Car. Me, personally, it's never been one of my favorite tracks. That's just taste. I'm not kind of criticizing the track.
Yeah, yeah.
Just not my personal taste. But for me, how you can have Rubber Soul without Nowhere Man is just stunning. I mean, it's one of John's classics from that album. There are four John classics on this album, which are, you know, Girl, In My Life, Nowhere Man, and Norwegian Wood. And to omit Nowhere Man, which is kind of where he was at in this period of his career, is an abomination for me.
Well, it would have been if they had wanted to include a single on the album. That would be the obvious go-to one.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, they did put it out as a single. And I think...
Not in the UK.
No. I'm talking about Capitol. That they probably had their sights set on that as something to boost another future Capitol album. And maybe they already had at least the rough idea of a Yesterday and Today in mind in December of 1965. It's like, okay, we've got enough material here, this bounty that we've described. You know, we can get another album out of this in the spring, except they didn't. They waited till, you know, like very late spring before they crafted Yesterday and Today. But it is very interesting. I don't know, have you ever seen that memo? And I think it's got Alan Livingston's name on it that's circulated. It's dated October 12th, 1965. It's an internal memo at Capitol Records. And this is while they're working on Rubber Soul. But it's about the idea that got floated of putting out a Paul McCartney solo album.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's what they had in mind was Yesterday had just been the hit single in America.
Do you reckon Paul was going, no way will I do that.
I don't think the words filtered out to his ears. And certainly I think they anticipated Brian's reaction would be no way.
Right.
Just as the Yesterday single was not credited to Paul McCartney. It was credited to the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, the following year with Pet Sounds,
Caroline No. I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Right. But it shows their thinking. It's like, well, how can we milk this cash cow further? You know, Paul's the popular Beatle. He's the pretty Beatle. He just had a number one with a solo performance. We can build an album around Yesterday and stick, you know, I Love Her on it and Michelle from the new work in progress. But they didn't. It got shot down. So it just shows you that Capitol definitely had a mindset of how can we take what we've got. And the fact that they left Nowhere Man off that album, it all but explicitly says we're going to build another album around this one because it's so good.
Yeah, I know. Well, okay, so that's how kind of there's one other track, isn't there, that it is different, which is The Word.
Yes.
And that's got some differences on it. We most likely could A-B it.
Okay. Okay. If you're now talking about not just different selection of tracks, but different treatment of tracks, yes.
Yeah, it has Lennon's double-tracked vocals, an extra falsetto harmony in the left channel during the last two refrains, and some percussion panning to the right and then the left channel during the instrumental break.
Yes. Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit of first the U.S. and then the U.K.
Think, Robert?
Well, see, again, I grew up on the Capitol stereo version, so I'm used to the features you describe there, the panning and the extra harmony and all that stuff. And I have to say, as much as I love the word, and I do love the word,
You know what the word is, don't you?
Love?
Yeah.
It's a great track. Yeah. I always thought it was a bit of an unsung track. You don't tend to hear that one on the radio, yet it's
wonderful,
a great
harmonies.
Performance. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and nobody's covered it.
No.
It's not like You Won't See Me, where at least you had the Ann Murray version, and
yes.
You know that song got a lot of traction. So, but anyway, having acquired the UK version at some point in the 70s, I don't think I listened to it that closely to go, oh, wow, that's different. Mm. It wasn't as obvious to me as the difference between I Feel Fine on Both Sides of the Atlantic. So, I mean, there it is, and I wonder how many listeners have ever noticed that difference before.
So did you come to the UK releases in terms of the albums, the Dexter-less mixes, mm-hmm. all in one go in the 1970s, where you suddenly just hit on these and went like, wow, and started listening to all of the UK versions?
I think that I must have had some level of awareness that they existed before I heard them. Like, you know, I was raised on the Capitol stuff, but I started buying the UK imports. And then I think I had nearly all of them, and then they put out that blue box set. It's like, thanks, guys. You know, I'd been buying them individually, and now I got to buy the damn box. But yeah, I was conscious because there was a like a little booklet that was sold back then called Every Little Thing.
When was this?
It was a mail order thing, and it was
when?
Oh, when?
Yeah.
77, 78, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean. I was aware, this was pre-internet, but there was somebody who had compiled all the variations, like, oh, the 45 of The Walrus has got an extra beat of music in there, and the fills are different and all this stuff. So I was actually consciously trying to collect all the variables I could.
Yeah.
The UK Red Album, I think, had a beginning difference on I Feel Fine, like you can hear the hi-hat closing or something like that. You know, all kinds of things. Oh, and the famous hi-hat count-off on All My Loving. That was on the Netherlands Beatles' Greatest album.
Right.
So some of the stuff was being bootlegged, but I was trying to collect all of it that I could. So I was aware that there were all these variations. And honestly, you know, as a kid in my teens, I was like, wow, well, this is what the Beatles wanted. So I gravitated toward the UK mixes as definitive because I thought, well, this is the legit version. And
oh, capital. Really?
Yeah.
So you weren't kind of going, oh, you know, whatever it was, I want to hold your hand. Wow, where's all the reverb? This kills
it. And once I heard the clean version of I Feel Fine and She's a Woman, I was like, well, damn, you know, the U.S. versions are abominations. And I knew that, yeah, they'd been tweaked for AM radio and, you know, millions of people grew up on them. I'm not going to tell you that they're wrong because obviously that was how you fell in love with the song and that's what's in your DNA by this time. I'm just saying my personal preference is I like the clean over.
Wow, so you had common sense and taste back then.
You know what? Everything, all my opinions are rooted in common sense and high-level thinking and critical analysis.
So what happened? When did that stop?
Well, there was this weight tied to my ankles once I started this show that kind of brought my standards down a little bit. But yes. I do fight that. Speaking, though, of variations, we'd started the show with the false start version of I'm Looking Through You. Mm. It's a great track regardless.
Absolutely.
I love it. But there's a lot to say about this track beyond the false starts, which we've kind of talked a little bit about. Mm. Once I started listening closely to this, it was like, here you've got this album that is so meticulously crafted. Mm. I mean, there's not a hair out of place in the entire album for the most part. Although I think we've talked on the show before about the fact that You Won't See Me, the tempo starts to drag at the end.
It does a bit. The backing vocals, you can tell they didn't loop the backing vocals because yeah. John and George start sounding a little bit ragged around the edges.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're running out of steam.
And knowing what we know about the production of this album, they were struggling to get it done in time. Mm. They were struggling with coming up with enough material for it. Mm. And that's why they had this leftover from Help, Wait, that they dusted off. Perfectly fine song.
Yeah.
And added some overdubs too. Some of that volume pedal guitar that George had been playing throughout the year. And, you know, there had been the 12-bar original that nearly made it till wiser heads prevailed.
Right.
So they had already done the initial attempt at I'm Looking Through You that was released on Anthology. Let's hear a little bit of that for anybody unfamiliar with how radically different it is.
I'm looking through you, where did you go? I thought I knew you, what did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed. I'm looking through you, you're not the same.
I remember the first time I heard that in the 80s when the Sessions bootleg started circulating.
Yes.
I thought, wow, this is cool. I'm glad they didn't put it out.
Yeah, exactly. It's like most of the things with the Beatles, maybe just a few exceptions, but in most cases, I do agree with the decisions they made.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the same as you. When I first heard it, it was like, oh, this is interesting.
They're really different.
Yeah, this is like, you know, a viable alternative, but
ultimately, that wouldn't have fit in with the whole rest of the album.
Right.
It's
ultimately,
so
they made the right decision.
They did. But, you know, it did occur to them that the song really, it's got the potential there, but it's not quite there yet. So Paul writes this bridge.
Mm.
Why? Tell me why. That's not in the original takes of
it.
But then they do it over from scratch. Now, this is the point I was trying to circle back to, is that they've got all this precision going on with this album. So meticulous. Everything. The harmonies and, you know, all the little instrumental motifs that go on.
Mm.
Yet this song, this as it exists, is so ragged. I mean, beyond the false start, which I love. I'm so glad that we have that. But you listen to this track, and you hear a tambourine being dropped. You hear feedback off and on. You hear these stray out-of-tune guitar notes playing. You hear a missed snare drum stroke by Ringo, presumably Ringo. I mean, that's the thing, is that there is a school of thought, a conspiratorial school of thought, that, you know, knowing what we know, how they rushed to get this album done, they'd already done one take that rejected, that maybe this has got the earmarks of being a Paul McCartney one-man band. Really, you know, recording where he's playing the drums and guitar, and that's why it's so sloppy. I'm not sure I would necessarily go there. And you've got the credit of Ringo on the organ.
Yes.
Yeah, which that's Mark Lewisohn apparently didn't hear because he says, I don't hear the organ.
Malorgan Evans.
No, that was on You Won't See Me.
On You Won't See Me,
No, you're right. That's the one he says
that's
clear.
That's the one he said he didn't
hear. Yeah, why?
Yeah, I know. And when I listened to
Did you ever have a sit down with him about that?
Well, at the time, I said to him when I saw the book, I said,
you can't say
You've just been listening to the multi-tracks. I said, but I can hear it in my head. I mean, you know, without even re-listening to the track. And then he kind of went, yeah, damn, you're right. I can hear
it. Is that how you just said it?
Yeah, well, something like that anyway. But
okay, anyway, my point being, you listen to this track, it's way sloppy.
Yeah.
But it's spirited.
Well, as George Martin said to me, which in the interview that appears in Beatles 101, I'll leave space for the bell, he, you know, said that often with these sort of cock-ups, basically, you know, whether it was vocal or instrumental, at the time it was all about the feel.
Yes.
And he said if the feel was right, I wasn't going to get them back in and say to them, we need to redo this. And I love that. You know, it makes it actually a bit more interesting for us now to sort of say, hey, you hear where he drops that tambourine or whatever.
And I love that stuff. That's the stuff that once you become aware of it, you start hearing it, it's like this really humanizes us.
Mm.
You know, the Beatles, are commonly regarded as so perfect and so untouchable. Mm. But just like I'd mentioned in other shows, like that little bit of Dropout that's in Day Tripper,
yes,
that they fixed for Beatles One. It's like, why'd you do that?
Right.
It's already
right.
sold millions, and it's,
yes,
you know, there was little. It's like it must be like a splice that you hear in Kansas City mm. during the instrumental break, mm. where it's like a Dropout in the ride cymbal.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know if they have it in UK or not, but we grew up at it, and I hate when they take out the impurities.
Rubber Soul is the album where the Beatles step up to the next level for me. You know, that they've been progressing all the way through, as they always did,
yes,
at a rapid rate. But with Rubber Soul as composers, they really suddenly go into another gear. Actually, three of them do.
Yeah.
And even Ringo, as I said, has got a co-composition credit. But, yeah, you know, but in terms of Lennon and
McCartney... Being more democratic.
Yeah, I know. But Lennon and McCartney, especially, go to a whole other level. I've already named four mm-hmm. really classic John songs on this album. And Paul, it's interesting because, you know, he's actually written songs here that are not necessarily the most commercial Paul songs, but they're real quality.
Well, Michelle was definitely, I think, everybody with ears had to have recognized, oh, you've got another Yesterday here.
Yeah.
A pop standard, which it was.
Interestingly, in Mark Lewisohn's Tune In, he mentions that like years earlier, I don't know if it was like 61 or something, where Paul's at a party.
Your student days.
Yeah, and he's sort of doing like the kind of bistro act.
Yeah.
He's got his guitar with him and he's serenading people as he's walking around. And it's basically Michelle.
Right. He had the tune. And in fact, I think it was John, in the course of making Rubber Soul, that pressed him, hey, why don't you finish that up? Mm. That would fit on this album.
Not the kind of number that you'd think John would be keen on finishing
up. Well, it shows how hard-pressed they were for material, that you're digging back that far. At least they didn't stick one after 909 on it.
Right.
But, you know, that was the number, too, that they got Ivan Vaughn, who would introduce those two.
Mm.
His wife, who I guess was a French teacher.
Yes.
Could you give me some French, meaning the language?
Yep.
to help me with this song.
Yeah.
Well, and Son des Mal qui volontaire ben ensemble was directly from her.
Yes.
And maybe in another world, there might have been a co-credit on there, or at least a thank you.
Right.
Not in Beatles world.
No, not in their world. You're right. My mother, who's French, always used to say, his French is perfect on there, that he gets it really right. I mean, the numerous examples of pop stars doing French, like Donovan on Jennifer Juniper, or, you know, they try and do a little bit of French, or and it doesn't come off quite. But she always said that line, where he does it in French, he really nails it.
The last time he says it is a little sloppier. Très bien ensemble.
Oh, is that really?
Yeah, my ears always caught that.
Yeah.
Well, but anyway, Ivan Vaughn's wife, whatever, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but
Mrs. Vaughn.
Yeah, due props to her.
Yeah, but getting back to, you know, the Paul compositions that you mentioned, I'm Looking Through You and You Won't See Me.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, wonderful songs. I think, you know, You Won't See Me is actually a very underrated Paul song. And I say underrated in that it's not one that the general public will necessarily be mentioning, you know, the one that springs to mind. It's not one of their famous singles.
It probably could have been.
It's a fantastic song.
It is. And we've actually, on the vocal show we did, we broke that down and played a bit of that.
Yeah.
So we don't need to revisit that here. But before we move on too quickly, I would make the case that I think it is astonishing the level of songwriting that John had risen to in 1965.
Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, I don't need to tell you more than once how great John Lennon is, but I would just say that as an album to that point, and I don't know, you know, the White Album songs that he did is another great set of songs, but they're very different.
Mm-hmm.
They're more personal.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think he really might have reached his zenith in terms of quality and quantity of songs he contributed to that album as just being, you know, universally appealing and an artistic new level for him.
When you think that he was 24 years old when he wrote these numbers that we're talking about, you know, In My Life and Girl, you'd think it's a much older, wiser head on those shoulders to write numbers like that. It's really now, you know, in my second half of my 50s listening to that and thinking the guy was 24 when he did those. It's just stunning.
Does his revisionist take of Girl was about Yoko and I hadn't met her yet, does that bother you?
Not really, because it was a kind of vague answer. He said it was about the kind of girl that I suppose we were all dreaming of meeting. It turned out to be Yoko. He never sort of said it, what, you know, he had visions of Yoko. I suppose bringing her into that does disturb me a bit. But
that was kind of the law.
When yeah,
he was yeah. given that, you know, the whole double fantasy.
I mean,
chat up.
You know, with Girl, it's interesting because you've got the tit 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 backing vocals and the kind
he
of
was
all...
thinking of Yoko when he. As we found out on Two Virgins.
but you know, that's the beginning, isn't it, of Beatles, you know, putting something in there, you know, for people.
Would you say
that's
the beginning?
Pick up.
It's a great example. Yeah. I know they talked about saying "Turn Me On" and "She's a Woman" was something they were like, "Ooh, let's see if we can get away with this."
Yeah.
So yeah, there, I think that undercurrent was kind of there,
right?
But there it's explicit.
It's explicit, and it's going to be part two. Is going to be the Frère Jacques backing vocals on "Paperback Writer"
right.
the next year.
Now, this is stuck in my head, and I didn't research it for the show, but it seems to me that I recall reading somewhere that somebody who Lennon respected actually said to him something along the lines, almost as a challenge, you know, the writing you do in your books, and Spaniard Works had come out, of course, by this time, you know, it's so sophisticated in your use of wordplay, and what you're doing there is so different from what you do in your songs.
Yeah.
Why don't you, like, think about merging them or trying to bring those elements into your music?
Yes.
And that he kind of digested that, and from that point on, 65 onward, started really running more with the wordplay and the imagery.
More personal, the songs became.
Yeah, they definitely were moving in that direction, at least as far back as, well, I mean, some can make the case that, you know, and I think we've said this before, There's a Place.
Yeah.
You know, he's definitely describing his inner life there.
Yes.
Explicitly, I'm a Loser, end of 64.
Well, it's a line in there, isn't it, with I'm a Loser. He throws in the line about, although I laugh and I act like a clown beneath this mask, I'm wearing a frown.
Well, and he was also saying it was another one of his retrospective, you know, he would say years later, cry for help, you know, I'm caught up in the stardom thing and I'm lost.
But
I'm
it's just the line. It's not the whole song. Help is more explicit, obviously. It's
literally
a cry for help.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fat Albus.
But by the time of Rubber Soul, we're really getting into it. I take it you've seen those handwritten lyrics for In My Life. At the beginning, you know, he already conceived it as a kind of journey through his life.
Yes, much as when he had started writing Nowhere Man, how he was trying to force something and it didn't happen. And then when he put it down and laid down, all of a sudden it all fell out.
I think he said in the Rolling Stone interview in 70 that he was trying to come up with a song. He couldn't think of anything. So then he got into this mindset of, you know, being useless and I'm a nowhere man. And he said it all came out in about less than half an hour.
Yeah. I love that song. And I kind of don't like the tie it has to Jeremy Boob, you know, as a visual.
Right.
I try to keep that separate.
Yeah, well, I do. I don't really think of it in that context. But, I mean, you know, Nowhere Man is, there's so much empathy. You see, this is the subtlety of the Beatles and the subtlety of Lennon's vocals. Is that he sings it with empathy for this note, whether it's about himself or whoever. Just listen to that voice. And also Paul's fantastic high harmony.
Yes.
You know, it's magnificent. The whole thing comes together.
Yeah, it's kind of like what he would do in the next album, And Your Bird Can Sing, where he's trying to impart some wisdom to somebody that it may as much be singing about himself, but you still get that conviction and that resonance with his inner life on record. And I think they're sort of a same cloth in a way.
The other thing with Girl is about, you know, did she know when she was young that pain would lead to pleasure? I mean, that's a kind of, that could be sexual, the pain leads to pleasure. Mm. He, in the interview, said it was a kind of reference to Christianity, whole, you know, you have to...
Which was very much on his mind.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been reading Passover Plot, like, a few months later.
Yes.
When asked by Maureen Cleave, which led to the whole More Popular Than Jesus.
Right.
Quote.
So the point is,
speaking of sexual, you know, Norwegian Wood.
Yeah.
And again, the speculation, you know, what affair was he writing about in this case?
Well, it's been rumored that it was Maureen Cleave.
That's one rumor. The other is Robert Freeman's wife.
Yes.
Sonny, was that her name?
Yep. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, or Alma Cogan.
Alma Cogan, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of suspects.
But, you know, when we talk about Norwegian Wood, of course, that's the track that introduced some sitar.
Yes, employing what George had already come into contact with earlier that year in the set of Help. And it's also interesting, you hear George has talked about it quite a bit, that, you know, John brings in this song, and I think they all felt it was kind of missing something.
Yes.
And he had made the suggestion, and John's like, oh, great, run with it. And so you hear the outtakes when they're kind of like trying to wrap their head around how can they make this work on this track.
Yeah.
And it was definitely a process. But yes. Then by this time, they had a little bit of luxury to sort of figure things out rather than rush to have this thing out the door.
Yeah, because the earlier versions of it, there's actually a bit more sitar where George is punctuating almost every line.
Yes.
Let's take a listen to that first.
Yes.
This bird has flown, take two.
Had a girl, or should I say, she once had me. She showed me her room, isn't it good, Norwegian wood. She asked me to stay and she told me to sit anywhere. So I looked around and I noticed there wasn't a chair. I sat on the rug, drinking her wine, biding my time. We talked until two, and then she said, it's time for bed.
So that's almost like what George wanted to do later to Hey Jude, isn't
yeah.
it? Kind of, you know, respond to almost every line with some guitar on that track. In this case, it's the sitar.
Well, maybe he should have done it with sitar and Hey Jude.
That would have been interesting.
The kiss off to the Indian years would yeah. have gone out with a bang.
But still, you know, this was at a point where he really didn't know how to play the sitar.
And it was a cheap one that he owned at the time. Wasn't
yes.
a quality one.
Right. It guaranteed not to split.
Right. but this was also the year that was kind of in the air.
Mm.
And I think we've talked about this before. The Kinks did See My Friend that year
yeah.
with this kind of drone going on.
Yes.
The Yardbirds had attempted a sitar version of Heart Full of Soul earlier
right.
that year.
Right.
And ended up having Jeff Beck just kind of imitate it on its telly.
Yes.
Because they couldn't properly engineer it to their satisfaction.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so it definitely was in the air. And of course, soon it'd be Brian Jones picking up on it as well. It'd be on Paint It Black for the Rolling Stones.
3 months later, right? That was the pattern.
Yeah.
The Beatles do something and 3 months later.
Yeah.
So how many months after yesterday was As Cheers Go By?
I don't know.
Pretty close.
Sure. Yeah, it is close, though. Okay. It is, yeah, it's the same right. year, isn't it?
That is the pattern.
Yeah. It is the pattern, but to their credit, they always did credible.
They delivered
numbers.
The goods.
Yeah, they
yes.
really did. And actually, I think Brian Jones playing on Paint It Black is superb.
It's a great embellishment.
Yeah.
It should have been co-credited to Bill Wyman, as it happens, who came up with the tune. Right,
right yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well. Yeah. They were as democratic as the Beatles.
Right. All right. So now we George, you know, yes. while we're on the subject, we should talk about him. Again, his songwriting, along with the rest of them, is really reaching a height here.
Yes.
Unseen to this point.
Yes.
You know, he gets his two tracks in the UK. We've talked about If I Needed Someone before on the Desert Island Show.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's one of my favorite compositions of his.
Yeah.
One of its great strong ones.
It's a wonderful recording as well, not just the composition. I think the recording, again, wonderful harmonies. I love Ringo's drumming and the percussion. It mm-hmm. just rolls along. It flows.
It's beautiful. It's yeah. fantastic. And there was that concurrent cover by the Hollies.
Yeah.
That he rather ungraciously publicly dissed. It started this little verbal war between him and Graham Nash. You're
yes.
familiar with that?
Yeah.
It didn't do real well, but then the Hollies blamed George's bad-mouthing it for it not, you know, getting as many spins as it might have.
Grumpy George.
Yeah, and they were the masters of the hit single that time.
Yeah.
You know, Look Through Any Window, Bus
yes.
Stop. I mean, superb stuff they were cranking out.
Yeah.
I just don't think this is one of their better recordings. But, you know, be that as it may, you know, here's George, who would be the financial recipient of any royalties of that record being a hit, and he's tamping it down.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like George's contributions on the Help album that year. You see,
oh, sure.
I think he's really beginning to find his feet as a songwriter.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And then Think for Yourself, which is just really characteristically for George, deceptively complex recording.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the harmonies, which now because we have the outtakes of them working, him and John and Paul trying to get the vocal parts just so, and they're kind of goofing around and stuff. And
yeah,
there's a little bit that made it into the Yellow Submarine film.
Yes.
And you've got time to...
I'm not sure it fits in with the whole folk rock patina.
It does not. It wouldn't have made sense if Capitol was, if that was their conscious aim, include If I Needed Someone and Drop, Think for Yourself.
Right.
But they didn't. So I really don't think that that was their thinking. Yeah. I think they were going for cohesion in their particular fashion.
Yes.
But the folk rock thing, no, not so much.
Now, the thing is, it was Rubber Soul was released in the UK December the 3rd, 1965, 3 days later in the US.
Yeah, so, Friday and Monday.
Yeah, so it's in time for Christmas.
Yep.
But really, you know, we always think of it, it's in my head, it's forever, it's 1965, because that's when they did it.
Right.
Know? But it was being heard by a large section of the public.
66.
In 66, yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And 66 is the year that it all changed, with everybody that really stepping up in these unbelievable landmark albums coming out.
Mm.
But here you have, you know, you can question or dispute the legitimacy of the Capitol U.S. Rubber Soul collection.
Mm.
However, this was the collection of songs that influenced Brian Wilson's, like, I've got to make an album now that's coherent and cohesive from start to finish of all great songs, giving the world a Pet Sounds, and God Only Knows, along the way. So, you know, you can't, you know, disclaim it as something unworthy when it had that kind of power.
Right. Now, I'm not sure the validity of trying to pair Beatles albums, you know, sort of saying, well, Revolver and Pepper, like, you know, Pepper's the kind of the sequel to Revolver, which I suppose it is in some regards. But interestingly, in Beatles Anthology, George said that, you know, Rubber Soul and Revolver for him were both good experiences, and he thinks of them almost as one, you know.
Yeah, one, like, and two.
Yeah.
A double record set.
Yeah.
I could see that, where certainly the great strides they were making artistically, not just in their songwriting, and that itself was huge, but in their use of the studio.
Yeah.
I mean, they are definitely the biggest leaps they'd made to that point as far as albums go.
Yes, I mean, you know, this is the point for me where you do sort of go, you know, with Rubber Soul, you listen to the material on there and sort of think, wow, a couple of years earlier they were doing She Loves You.
Or, right.
You know, 18 months earlier they were doing A Hard Day's Night. It's suddenly a real sort of game changer, isn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, the production is matching the effort made with the songwriting.
And another thing that, you know, I don't think we've ever discussed particularly on this show, but it's, you know, album covers. They always had fantastic album covers, the Beatles. Even, you know, the first one, Please Please Me, was just the four of them posing there at the EMI headquarters. But it's an iconic photo. It's a great shot. And, you know, with the Beatles, of course, which was Meet the Beatles in the US, another iconic shot by Robert Freeman in this case. And now we're into the Robert Freeman era of album covers, Hard Day's Night and Help. And now Rubber Soul, and for me, one of their finest ever album covers.
Well, it's very interesting that as much as they were taking the sounds they were laying down in the studio and then manipulating them, particularly as they would, you know, all out on Revolver, you know, slowing down the tape, speeding up the tape, turning it backwards.
Yeah.
So too did they with this cover. Quite serendipitously, they were being shown the transparencies of the shots he had made, and it was, they were projecting them onto a piece of white cardboard.
Yeah.
And then the cardboard had slipped back.
Yes.
Stretching and distorting the images.
Yes.
And they were like, "That's it."
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing how this pure, uncontrived circumstance could lead to this very, you know, iconic cover.
I once spent an evening at Robert Freeman's home. He was showing me all this collection of photos. It's fantastic. He was just, you know, like, take a look at all of this. And he said to me that with the Rubber Soul album cover, it wasn't until he was developing that sequence of photos that he realized in that shot that John was the only one looking at the camera.
Right. Yeah, and very strikingly. And the way they put it on the cover, where he's kind of center with the other Beatles alongside, George looking off and Ringo looking down and Paul looking off.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't have composed it for a 12 by 12 piece of cardboard any better.
Yeah.
It's absolutely perfect.
And I have to say, you know, I'm the first one. I'm always jumping on Paul for scene stealing, okay? And he was and is, you know, a prime scene stealer, and many examples of him in photos or on film where he basically does something to grab the attention, and John even referred to that. But I think John did it as well in his own way, just sometimes more subtly. I'm not sure it's subtle on this album cover, but there are quite a few photos I've noticed of the Beatles where the only one looking at the camera is John often. He kind of knew how to impose himself in a different way.
Yeah, well, in the photos that ended up being used, for sure. And maybe that was what made them the keepers, what made them so striking.
Yeah.
Now, getting back to the music again, we have In My Life, which was one of, I think, only two songs where you had John and Paul each independently discussing the creation of it.
Yes.
And that they dispute.
Right.
Most, they're pretty much in sync about, you know, who wrote what and all that stuff. Mm. And In My Life is one of these songs that there was an absolute difference of opinion where John said it was pretty much all him.
Yeah.
And Paul helped him with the bridge, the middle eighth, as he put it.
Yeah.
And Paul's like, no. John had the words. I was the one that came up with the melody.
Right.
And so there we are. And that's something I've tried to kind of unpack through the years. It's like, well, how can they both be, you know, does it come down to who you want to believe? And it kind of hit me one day, and this is the kind of thing where it helps if you're a musician, I guess, or if you're around musicians. But somewhere I seem to recall reading John saying something like, I borrowed from only you for that. And if you look at the chord sequence,
yes,
I think all but one chord, it is the same pattern.
Right.
He changed the second chord, I think, to E rather than C sharp minor or whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, you could see that, but that doesn't negate Paul. If John, in fact, borrowed the chord sequence, you know, chord sequence is not a melody.
Yeah.
And Paul imposed that melody on top of it. Yes. They're both right.
Right.
And further proof of, you know, proof, but just make of it what you will. The fact that if you take the later single, A Woman is the N-Word of the World,
yes,
and put it in the key of A, it's the same pattern.
You mean Woman is the Nigger of the World?
Well, you know. Yeah. Sensibilities, Richard.
It's the song title. It's what he sings.
It
if
is.
You play it. That's what he sings.
But you get the gist.
Yeah.
No matter how it's expressed.
Yeah.
But again, you look at that chord sequence, and it's there.
Yeah.
You know, very different song. But you know, I'm sure there's musicians listening to this that can check this out, and you know, write on our Facebook page or our somethingaboutthebeatles.com page what you think. But that was my observation.
And
I think it's very
striking. There was a subsequent Beatle tweak to In My Life when George toured in '74. One of the things that brought the wrath of the fans down on his head was substituting in My Life I Love You More at the end to In My Life I Love Him More.
I love God more.
Yeah, referring to the deity.
The Almighty, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, you wonder what kind of passive aggression was going on there. You know, him and John were having, you know, being on the outs at that time.
Yeah.
And John was supposed to join the tour at the Madison Square Garden show,
yeah,
which would have been great if he had actually done it and they'd sang In My Life together.
Yeah.
You know, they're each on their own mic and one singing you and the other singing God.
Yes.
That would have been a great visual. But it didn't happen.
By the way, the title of the album, which we were referring to before, you know, Rubber Soul.
Plastic Folk.
Plastic Folk. You know, that was the soul boom right then. And especially in the UK, there was a kind of soul boom. And there is that, you know, on the multi-tracks when they're working on the album, you hear Paul referring.
Rubber Soul, man?
Yeah, and Plastic
I'm
Soul.
I'm down.
Yeah.
When they recorded at 65.
And he keeps saying Plastic Soul, man.
Plastic Soul. Yeah, it's like
Let's listen to that.
Plastic Soul, man. Plastic Soul. Plastic Soul, man. Dude.
And you know that original term, or Plastic Soul, was originally, contrived as a description of Mick Jagger.
Really?
Yeah. As being, you know, a white guy singing soul badly or fakely.
So Plastic Soul as opposed to asshole.
I suppose, different context, but and so that was what Paul was picking up on when he got that, you know, stuck in his head.
And he's going, Plastic Soul, man.
Yeah.
Plastic Soul, yeah.
And then they come around and make an album title out of it later, a variant of that.
So Rubber Soul at 50, how do you think it's aged?
Wonderfully.
Yeah.
It, like so much Beatle music, it's got so much timelessness to it. It's not tied to the production of its day.
Mm.
I mean, it's acoustic instruments largely, or piano, or organ, or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, ensemble vocal harmonies.
Yes.
It's all stuff that doesn't go out of date.
Right, I agree. I think we've got into an era, you know, when it was like the 70s, it was like, oh, when I was at school, it was like, oh, the Beatles are passé, you know, yeah. And I was fighting that battle, you know, kind of thing. But I think we've got to a point now where it's all kind of appreciated as mm-hmm. classic in one form or another. But these compositions, they're so strong.
Yeah, the ones that are strong. It's funny. Yeah. I always found it very striking once I started getting thoughtful about what I was listening to that they end the album with Run For Your Life,
yes.
which is such a throwback. You know, it's an album that easily could have fit on Beatles For Sale as this rockabilly.
Yeah, record. And I'm also glad you mentioned it because, you know, 7 years later, Lennon, as you were saying, you know, with, you know, the woman is the N-word of the world. You know, I mean, a complete 180 once, you know, he's got together with Yoko in terms of his misogynistic opinions. And, it's like, wow, this was the guy in 65, you know, your northern man, mm-hmm. you know, just putting the woman down. It's a real put-down song. It's extremely aggressive.
Channeling Elvis.
That's right, the line, I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man, which is from Baby Let's Play House.
Right, but you look at, you know, they made it a habit of trying to end strong on their records.
Mm.
I mean, you know, Twist and Shout,
yeah.
Money.
Yes.
And then for A Hard Day's Night, it's I'll Be Back, which has got this sort of open-ended, you know, because of the unresolved D and a D minor thing.
Right.
It's still a striking ending.
And Help Is Dizzy Miss Lizzy?
Yes.
Yes.
You know, it's a big powerhouse
That's
rocker.
Right.
They played live that year.
Yeah.
Beatles For Sale is Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby, which got that tag on it. That's, you know, something they did live.
Right.
When they were playing it in the clubs. So it's a real curiosity that they ended this album that is so eclectic, and it starts with, you know, the Motown-esque Drive My Car and runs through, you know, this whole array of styles, you know, the French, the pop, the, you know, faux Baroque. In England, it had that country, you know, What Goes On track.
Yes, yeah.
That this is what they ended with.
Well, but then looking at the tracks, I'm not sure what would have been better. I suppose the only other one I would have maybe finished with would have been The Word.
Or Nowhere Man.
Mm,
that resounding chord. Dun, 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 tish. It's got a nice splash ending.
Yeah,
to it.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I don't hate it. It's just interesting that was what they thought, oh, this has got to be the closer.
Yeah. But as I was saying, that I think that the, you know, in terms of the really great songs on here, and there are certainly a fair few, the extra depth to the compositional process here in terms of, you know, the meaning in the songs and just the sophistication of the arrangements makes them more timeless.
If this had been their final album, if they had split up or something happened after that, what a way to go out.
Yeah.
If they'd done nothing more after Rubber Soul, this was their last musical statement, along with We Could Work It Out and Day Tripper, you know, just they would still be thought of as, wow, what a immensely talented group these guys were.
Yes.
And instead, they just took it further and higher and higher.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is the point where they're leaving the beat group.
Absolutely.
Know, person behind, right? That ends with Help, really.
They're dabbling. You know, John had talked about, there was that quote that I have in my Revolver book where he's, I think it was in Beatles Monthly, he's talking about Brian Wilson, the song that the Beach Boys had produced in the fall of 65, The Little Girl I Once Knew, which was not on an album.
Yes.
And he's saying, this is what happens. You know, he stays home and he is able to work out all his musical ideas because he's not on the road. You know, this is what can happen if you're not playing live. You can actually come up with this great advanced musical stuff.
Yes.
So you get that was part of their sensibility at the time. How much further can we take this?
Yeah.
And you know, they might have been a little bit hamstrung by, as great as a lot of the compositions were, I think they were feeling the squeeze of not having enough high quality material.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they brought in, you know, the Wait outtake from Help, which is a perfectly good song, but maybe they felt wasn't it good enough for Help?
Right.
You might ask.
Yeah.
They work out this 12-bar original, which was, you know, complete waste of time.
Yes.
Didn't go anywhere.
Yes.
But at least they recognized it at the time and didn't try to shoehorn it in there somehow.
Right.
But they managed to pull it off despite themselves.
Yes.
And it just they had this other material around that could have been worked onto it, and they didn't.
Sonically, this is also the last album with Norman Smith as the recording engineer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be going with a younger guy, Jeff Emmerich, and he's going to be pushing the envelope sonically more.
Right.
Kind of happens at the right time.
It does. I mean, they all were in that mindset at the time.
Yes.
And, you know, George Martin as well.
Yes.
And they had the perfect facilitator for that in 20-year-old Jeff Emmerich.
Yeah. But it is, it's a great collaborative effort. That's the beauty of this album. You know, we always talk about Revolver, maybe being the finest example of that, and maybe the final example of that.
Yes, the four-man, all on the same page, pulling in the same direction.
Absolutely.
Mindset.
Yeah, but Rubber Soul is also, and that's why I think George links the two, because it's just wonderful collaboration.
I think it's informed by the same sensibility.
Yes.
Yeah. And speaking of, at that time in the fall, while they're working on this album, you've got them getting ready for Christmas, and in the tradition, got to have a message out.
Yes.
And so you've got them cutting the 1965 Christmas message during the Rubber Soul sessions.
Right.
And it's a great and timely place to end the show.
Yes.
And listening to it, you know, they're drawing in all these other songs. Eve of Destruction, Barry Maguire, they're making fun of.
Yes.
Same old song.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Four Tops. But
and again, like as we said once before on a previous show, that the Christmas records are kind of, if you listen to them back to back, it's almost like a microcosm of the Beatles' career, the Beatles' story. And in 65, again, it captures them right in that era where they're getting a bit political, talking about Vietnam on here. And the record itself was a bit more sophisticated than what had preceded it.
They're making fun of Yesterday throughout.
Yes.
But also, it's the last of the original style, where it's just them cutting up in the studio and actually kind of going through the motions of, with like, the thank you fans. You know, you look at what followed a year later, after they'd made Revolver and after they'd started recording Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane and When I'm 64, you know, they start actually enacting like a little radio play.
Yes.
For 66.
Yes.
They take it even further in 67.
Yeah.
And then 68, all separate parts just flown in and stitched together.
So here we are in the Beatles' mid-period, as I'd like to call it. And, you know, really at the height, aren't they?
It's a real transition period here.
Yes, it is.
The old Beatles being left behind, the new Beatles, they're entering that doorway.
Yeah, they're about to do their last UK tour.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we're moving into a whole other era here. My name is Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been Something About the Beatles.
Beatles. All my trouble seems so far away. Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.
Don't forget, Christmas is coming. Oh, that reminds me. Let's do a Christmas record.
Let's do a Christmas record.
Yeah, what should we say?
That's a good idea.
Ad-lib. We've got to thank everyone. Remember to thank.
Yeah, thank
you. You can't ad-lib too much because you miss. Well, thank you, Johnny. It's been nice to know you.
Got to thank everyone for all the presents this year.
Yes.
All for buying the records.
Yeah, especially the chewed up pieces of chewing gum and the playing cards made out of knickers.
On behalf of John and I, George speaking, I'd like to thank you for all the Christmas cards and presents and birthday cards and presents and everything too, as well.
On behalf of George and I, I'd just like to thank you all for the Christmas present and all the rest of it.
Thank you. Well, Ringo, what have we done this year?
I see you haven't shaved again.
Well, Ringo, what have we done this year?
We've done a lot of things this year, Paul.
Yes.
Well, we've been away.
Yeah.
And like last year.
Hey, we've come back all right.
Aye. We've had a lot of presents sent to us for our birthdays and Christmases.
Yes, we'd like to thank you.
Thank you for the presents and the cards.
Thank you for the presents.
Happy Christmas to your listeners, wherever you can do. We belong to everybody, don't you nick your new. Away to the Jack McGregor upon his bunny hoe. Hack your bunny Christmas with a pound of Irish stew.
Thank you, John.
Down in Virginia with the old black door, we got some, we got some. Down in Virginia with the old black door, we got some, we got some.
For the sake of old lang syne, my dear, for the sake of old lang syne. One upon the two or three.
Well, for the sake of old lang syne, that reminds me, Ringo.
Yes.
Last year.
You was here.
We was here, around the same old mic, down in the studio.
Same old guitar, same old faces.
It's the same old song, but a different meaning.
Copyright, Johnny.
Copyright, can't say that.
Hey, all right, what are we going to do? What's out of copyright?
How about we'll get the lilacs in an old brown shoe?
Yes, that's out of copyright.
But,
let's play a request for all the boys in B-E-A-O-R-E.
Yeah, all right.
What do we play for them? Because there's some, we got some fans in the forces.
Well, here in Munich, it's not quite as fine as it is in London.
Well, Kenneth, the weather's raining here. It's not very good.
Oh, it's not bad over here, but some of, you know, we've had a bit of rain and all that.
Yeah. Stay tuned in. It's a five-way link-up.
If you've enjoyed this programme, tune to 29314567 megacycles. If you can't find that, drop it.
She could be a queen and be a forgotten river. Brought to him, China, down in Vietnam, and China, and look at all those bodies,
Jordan, China, floating in the river, Jordan.
Well, that looks as though it's about it for this
year.
Well,
that should cover Israel.
We certainly tried our best to
please everybody.
Please everybody. If we haven't done what we could have done, we've tried.
And if you haven't got yours, send fourpence in and get a free one.
And seeing as we gather around the Christmas microphone here in the studio, we might as well get together with a little Christmas message for you.
Which goes something like this.
Christmas comes but once a year, but when it does, you know it's here because we've got
singing.
Christmas comes but once a year, but when it does, it brings good cheer because we've got the
for Christmas.
Yesterday, you are all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay.
Oh, bless
you all
this
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
This year has turned out to be a big year for us.
Christmas Day.
One of our biggest years since we can remember.
Christmas Day.
And we can remember a lot of big years. Take bugs.
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day.
And especially those abroad and those of you in BOR 245-9783.
Christmas Day.
There's a lot of us here, one of which a lot of you there, and the weather's perfectly all right, thank you. And don't forget, the old and the new, some folks blue and some folks green. You take no notice of them, it's an all-white policy in this group.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Looks as though they're here to stay.
Looks as though
bless you all on Christmas Day.
But once a year.
Aye, and when it comes, it brings good cheer. So don't
Christmas Day. I'm the bad to my Christmas Day.
And I've made it there, Charlie.
Okay, put the red lights off.
And this is Johnny Rhythm just saying good night to you all and God bless you.
All right, well, that's got it done then. What are we going to do now?
Has he turned it off?
I think he has. Have you turned it off, lad?
Hey, Basher.
And they're still the same.
Turn it off, Basher.
The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.